Connie Field has called her 8.5-hour documentary series about the global human rights movement that led to the end of apartheid in South Africa, Have You Heard from Johannesburg? As she conveys in her film, the struggle for civil rights in South Africa didn't only take place in the streets of Durban and Cape Town, but also in sports arenas, churches, and corporate boardrooms all over the world. The film opened a two-week run yesterday at Film Forum on West Houston Street, and Connie Field joins us today, along with Adjoa Dunn-Mouton, who worked as an anti-apartheid activist with Trans Africa. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today. Hi.
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 Let's begin with you, Connie. Many of your previous films have focused on American issues, like The Life and Times of Rosie the Riveter. What inspired you to take on this project?
Well, actually, what I was most interested in is because it was global. And I sort of believe that we can learn a tremendous amount from history to inform what we need to do today. And we really live in a globalized world. And so the way that this was handled on that level, I think, has a tremendous amount to give to us on how to, you know, deal with problems we need to deal with today.
Although the film also points out that this was an American story.
Yes.
And before we get to that, and Adjoa, just curious about how this thing is being shown. Film Forum has divided this 7-part documentary into 3 parts, each with its own intermission. Do the individual films stand alone?
3 middle films were actually made to stand alone because they're they're an entire campaign. One is on the international sports boycott. The other is about the movement in America, which led to the political isolation of apartheid, which was really important. And the other had to do with actually getting companies out of South Africa to affect the economy so that the the Afrikaner Party would come to the negotiating table. So those are really meant to stand on their own. The rest are not, but they're sort of each their own story, in a way.
Adjoa, what was the policy of the United States toward South Africa during the 1960s, at the time of our civil rights movement?
The policy was one of engagement with the apartheid government, a real sense that they were allies and the U.S. government supported them.
Because they were also anti-communist?
That is primarily why. It is definitely played out as a Cold War allies. And I think that it's very interesting to look at it because it's really very clear that South Africa figured out how to remain allies with the U.S. government and continue to use the anti-communist position as how they should be viewed in the world.
Did the major push against apartheid in the United States begin after important civil rights legislation for our country was finally enacted?
Yes, it did. In fact, many of the members of Congress who came after the civil rights legislation, especially members of the Congressional Black Caucus, were really they were the fruits of the civil rights movement, that they were able to win their elections because of the Voting Rights Act.
Connie, one person in your film is quoted calling the ANC terrorists propped up by the Soviets.
That was Ronald Reagan.
Well, we remember him. But there were, South Africa had some very powerful defenders in Congress. I remember reading defenses, not just because it was anti-communist, but there were predictions of a bloodbath if the black majority gained power. There was talk about what are those things where they put tires around people and then set them on fire?
I
kept on hearing about that as a major threat.
Right. That was it was called necklacing. And in the 80s, which was a fairly violent period in South Africa, and especially violent the government towards the movement in South Africa. But also there was a lot of spying that went on then, a lot of infiltration. So there were, you know, life isn't simple. People aren't saints. And often if someone was a traitor in their midst, they would necklace them, which means put a tire around someone, douse it with gasoline, and set it on fire. Now, this wasn't something that was, you know, rampant all over. It was just, you know, isolated incidents, but it got brought up and into, you know, the news, and people used it to show this is what's going to happen in South Africa if the whites don't remain in power.
How did, Adjoa, the grassroots campaign reach Congress, and why was it successful in the end?
Well, I think it was, on your first point, it reached Congress really through the grassroots movement, but also because there were the congressional members who themselves felt that the policy needed to change. So that you have people like Congressman Diggs and Congressman Dellums who start very early talking about the need to pull for the U.S. to pull out of South Africa. And so that made it ripe for activists who have been working on this issue for a number of years, but not really having much traction within the Congress. And I think that what brings it closer together is the movement swells, but also the movement inside of South Africa becomes so violent and so open to the rest of the world through, you know, through television primarily, that there begins to be a real re-engagement, I think, by the activist movement.
But didn't some people argue that sanctions always hurt the wrong people, that it's the poor people who wind up suffering most?
Oh, that's a big Absolutely. Argument that was used, absolutely. And and the people that supported that also would try to show every single little reform that the Afrikaner Nationalist Party did showed that it was going in the right direction. Certainly Margaret Thatcher used that a lot.
Yeah, I remember at a hearing for the Africa subcommittee, we had a South African, and he said, think about a ladder when you think about sanctions, and you stack people on the ladder by the way in which they are, where they rank within the society, and then you push the ladder over. Who gets hurt the most? Is it the people on the top or the people on the bottom? And the argument had been that if you push sanctions, if you have sanctions, that it will impact the very people who we want to help, which were the poor people, poor Africans.
And that did happen in Iraq and in a number of other places. But I remember speaking to South Africans at the time who said, yes, we will suffer, but if it brings about an end to all of this, then it's worth the suffering and the sacrifice.
Well, there's a real difference between South Africa and Iraq. And the real difference is that the people who were fighting to free themselves in South Africa came up with a strategy. It was their strategy. And part and they asked the world to participate with them to effectively change. And this was, they called for it.
Now,
so it was totally different than Iraq.
We've been seeing recently just how hard it is to get 60 votes in Congress. Adjoa, you and your allies were able to persuade Congress to override President Reagan's veto of
That's correct.
The sanctions.
Yes. In the Senate, over 78 senators supported the overriding of the veto.
And Connie, the film that we've been mostly talking about in this part of the conversation, From Selma to Soweto, argues that this was the first time that African Americans had influenced U.S. foreign policy.
To this degree, yes. It's a major point in history, yeah.
Now, Nelson Mandela, well, first of all, I should tell people who I'm talking with. Connie Field is the director of a new film called Have You Heard from Johannesburg, which is currently in a two-week run at Film Forum. Also with us is Adjoa Dunmutten, who was one of the people who actually worked to change things from Washington, and she's talking to us right now from Washington. Nelson Mandela doesn't appear much in this film. The film kind of ends not long after he is released, but Oliver Tambo, the deputy president of the ANC, perhaps not as well known, in some ways is the hero of the story, isn't he?
He is, absolutely. I mean, he He was quite an amazing man. This is, to me, a really great story, and it's filled with heroes and villains and hypocrites and saints. It's quite amazing. And Oliver, I think, was an incredibly special person because he was one of those rare people who could function on so many different levels. He could clearly articulate what their needs were in South Africa, what they were fighting for. He could was an incredible organization man. It's very hard. I mean, their entire organization was in exile. They were banned. They couldn't operate, you know, they could only operate underground inside South Africa. What it meant to keep that together and all the different levels that they had to work in, he was just magnificent.
He was mostly in exile in London, but...
No, he was in exile in many places in Africa and...
And he finds allies in the newly independent African countries during the 60s and works with them to get the UN to change things, to apply sanctions. That doesn't happen. Then he petitions the Soviet Union to help build a guerrilla army, a decision that ends up haunting him.
Well, it does in a way because it put him smack in the, you know, the vice of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. It was pretty impossible for anybody to avoid that during that time, even though people, little countries tried to do that. And he didn't have a choice. He actually first asked the West to support his struggle, and they wouldn't do it. And so once he accepted, you know, that support from the Soviet Union, it meant that it could be used against him, which it was.
Mm-hmm. And was that something that you had to deal with in Washington, Ajua?
Yes, absolutely, because there was always an argument by those who were supportive of the South African government that they were terrorists, that they were a part of the Soviet Axis, and it was to support the ANC and the movement was actually to be not with our allies. It was a continuous fight, until the end, an argument that was used over and over again.
Well, the Communist Party in South Africa was a strong advocate for ending the system, and so there was no way to get around that.
Well, of course it was. This Communist Party in South Africa was the first integrated organization. in the 40s and earlier. It was banned by 1950. There was no, on the surface, operating Communist Party members. but they were certainly human beings that were still there. Yeah, they were the people that worked hand in hand all the way down to the most difficult tasks with the ANC. It were those people.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with Connie Field, who's the director of a new film called Have You Heard from Johannesburg. She's talking with us along with Ajua Dunmutan, who is one of the people featured in the film, which just began a two-week run at Film Forum on West Houston Street in Manhattan. We'll be back with more right after this. We're back with Ajua Dunmutan, who worked as an anti-apartheid activist with Trans Africa, influencing American policy about South Africa, and Connie Field, who has put together an 8.5-hour, 7-part documentary series called Have You Heard from Johannesburg, which began a 2-week run at Film Forum at 209 West Houston Street in New York. The fourth film, Connie, is called Fair Play, and it's about the role of the South African rugby team in this movement. Why was the rugby team, the Springboks, such a critical target for the anti-apartheid movement?
Well, you know, with the idea to try to isolate the apartheid government and in order to get them to move politically, one of the arenas that really worked was in sports because they were sports fanatics. And it was also one place where they had great international pride. They had the best rugby team in the world, practically. The only team that could come close to them was New Zealand. And it was the pride of the people. And it's also, you know, it's how you engage in the world and how you show your prowess. New Zealand, it was the same thing. They were a rugby-mad country completely because this is how they showed themselves to beat the Brits. Both these countries that used to be sort of colonies of Britain came out of that, could, you know, flex their muscle with their rugby team and beat them. So it meant a tremendous amount.
Especially to Afrikaners who resented the British in the first place.
Exactly, exactly.
So how did the rugby players react to all the unrest and to all the attention they were receiving?
It was hard on them. It was to go into countries where basically your games are stopped because too many people are running on the field trying to stop the game. People used a tactic called, you know, direct action. It was very effective against these games, and it was very difficult for them.
And they took it very seriously, obviously. Dennis Brutus, the main architect of the sports boycotts against South Africa, says that a South African policeman said to him after he was arrested, "We're not going to handcuff you because we're hoping you'll try to escape so we can kill you."
Exactly.
That's exactly. Taking a boycott seriously.
Yeah.
How was this playing out at all in Washington, Adjoa? Were people aware of this?
Yes, they were. They were aware because the sports boycott also had, you know, other elements. One of those was Arthur Ashe and the tennis players. So that you have a whole set of other people who are Washington-based, but they're not as tied to the major sports. But still, the whole idea of a sports boycott was very much a part of the talk in Washington.
And South Africa was banned from the Olympics from 1964 to 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And that's despite what was considered a very conservative IOC.
Well, it's because it's a very interesting story. you know, during the 60s, more and more countries in Africa gained their independence, and they became a major force in the General Assembly at the United Nations, but could actually never affect what the UN would do because the UN is controlled by the Security Council and by the five countries who have the right to veto anything that happens. So it's interesting because especially in this country where a lot of African Americans first gained, you know, sort of social power through sports because they were good at it. Africa as a continent really could first really seriously influence the world through sport. And it was really their efforts at building coalitions and dealing, and Dennis was very involved with all of this, Dennis Brutus. They formed alliances with other countries, especially other Asia and other countries like that and Eastern Europe. They were big enough to basically cause the IOC, who is very conservative, to act. They didn't have a choice, else it wouldn't have been Olympics those years.
Well, sports deals with national pride, but it wasn't it the business boycotts that really eventually tightened the screws the most?
Yeah, from what I can see, that had the most important impact on South Africa.
Banks started pulling out. Companies started pulling out, sometimes because they had to, but in other cases because they just thought that it was the right thing to do.
Well, somewhat, but it became more an issue because of the movement in South Africa in the 80s, it became an unsafe place to invest, period. And probably one of the most significant moves that happened, and this Chase Manhattan Bank, when it refused to roll over its loans, I think now because we've gone through this big economic crisis here and the housing crisis, people understand what it means if you can't get your loan. You know, Americans really understand that now. Well, that's what happened to the whole government. And that was kind of the key pin. And he did it largely because, he saw this country going up in smoke, and this was not a safe place. And once he did it, other banks followed. And this was a huge death knell, you know. And so I think this was extremely significant.
You spoke to a fair number of people who'd been in the government. You didn't get P.W. Botha. You used mostly his public statements. But what is their thought now, now that in retrospect, do they still think that they were doing the right thing?
No, it depends on the person. I don't think so. I think you would find a lot of people in South Africa who would, you know, say they weren't supportive of apartheid, even though
but
they were.
I'm talking about the people in government. For example, I spoke to F.W. de Klerk. He was on the show in June 1999, and he came across as rather reasonable on the subject. You'd never know that he'd once been a rabid defender of apartheid. He was quite proud of the fact that he saw the light and freed Nelson Mandela. So and I think he saw himself as one of the heroes of the story.
Of course they do. That's what I mean. They will tell you that. I mean, there's very few people, really only the very right wing, like Sarah Blanche, the guy that got killed recently, Tara Blanche. His organizations, those people would come out and say that they had a better system and they believe in going back to that system. But they're probably one of the few this day would do that.
One person in the film argues that if Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher hadn't been elected, it would have been impossible for apartheid to have lasted as long as it did.
Well, if it's more if they hadn't been taking the positions that they took. Yeah, they're right. They're absolutely right.
Archbishop Tutu remembers at one point in the film that he said to President Reagan, "Mr. President, your history is bad."
Yes.
What was the context for that?
He was talking about the South Africans being their ally in World War II. And so the relationship goes way back to that. And Tutu pointed out that many of the people that Reagan was dealing with now had been Nazi supporters during World War II. So that's what he meant. He had his history wrong.
And Adjoa, how did President Reagan respond?
Oh, he was very upset. In fact, it's very noticeable. It was very noticeable. Even though Bishop Tutu, when he came out of the meeting, was very nice, but you could see that the anger in Ronald Reagan's face, and Bishop Tutu talked with Congress at a hearing afterwards and talked of his disappointment, that he was sorry that he was unable to convince the president that he was very wrong.
Well, it is history. He could have just looked it up. Adjoa Dunn Mutton is one of the people featured in Connie Field's film, Have You Heard from Johannesburg? It's at Film Forum, and it's in a two-week run with the seven films being broken up into groups over three-day periods. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There are so many little anecdotes that were brought out during your interviews, Connie. For instance, when you interviewed Connie Bram, an anti-apartheid activist in Amsterdam, and he tells you of arranging floppy disks to be clandestinely transported between Mandela and Oliver Tambo via sympathetic KLM flight attendants.
Oh, that story, I love this. This is a great story. There was a tiny organization called Operation Vula in the late 80s, and there were only five people who were part of this organization. And Oliver Tambo was one. This marvelous guy, Mac Maharaj, was another. Connie Bram was the only, you know, activist, you know, outside of the ANC to be part of this. And she committed 25 years of her life to this struggle, if not more. And so what she did, this is an amazing story. What they were trying to do, they needed to make their underground operate. And many people were located in the states outside, right outside South Africa. And so they needed to be able to get back into South Africa and conduct the struggle there. And so she did a couple of things. She got actors to help people make up and dentists to provide false teeth and so they could go in all disguised. And really amazingly, she got people from Holland to move to South Africa, move there, get a house, get yourself some kind of job, basically be a cover so that the underground people could all go stay there. The servants who were working with you were part of the underground. It's amazing to me that she got people to do that, as well as a KLM stewardess who was the courier.
But how do you smuggle stuff into a prison where Nelson Mandela is being watched day and night?
His lawyer did it. Mandela's lawyer did it.
And why was that correspondence important?
It's the way that Mandela and Tambo planned strategy together for what was going to occur. They worked it out together.
The film ends partly in celebration with Mandela's international tour and his appearing before Congress and the UN, but there are signs of confusion and disillusion to come. Anti-apartheid activist Murphy Morobe says that the historical moment felt somewhat anticlimactic. Just this little ballot, and what next?
Right, well, that's a big question. I mean, because it's, once you've won a struggle like this, in a way, the biggest struggle is afterwards and how you really change things. And a lot of people have, when I've gone around with the film, a lot of people have expressed a lot of disappointment in South Africa. People had such high hopes. And what I tell people are two things. One, it hasn't been that long. What's it about? 15 years. Mm-hmm. And that's not a long time. The other thing I tell them, I made a film about the civil rights movement in Mississippi.
And Freedom on My Mind.
Yes. And a wonderful person in that film, Bob Moses, who's just an amazing human being. What he told me about what they did in Mississippi when they won the vote was they just brought Mississippi up to the level of the rest of the country. They didn't solve the problems of Mississippi, and that's all that's happened in South Africa.
Well, Adjoa, let's look at some of the problems. Despite its wealth, South Africa remains a country with a huge gap between the rich and the poor. It has a sometimes shocking policy on dealing with HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. It's continued to support Robert Mugabe's deteriorating regime in Zimbabwe. Some of the ANC leaders have been embroiled in very embarrassing personal scandals and in corruption scandals. So isn't 15 years long enough to get past some of those things?
Well, I think 15 years is not long enough, especially when you have really several sets of people. People who have been educated outside of the society in which they're serving, people who have been under a kind of a rule of, you know, of kind of watching what other people have done that has not been, you know, in the best interest of the people. I think that the struggle for freedom is the first phase, and this is the second phase. And the anti-apartheid struggle started very early on. You know, from the beginning of apartheid, people were struggling within South Africa, supported by people outside, to change that system. And it's going to take a long time for South Africa to make the kind of changes that are really going to be in the best interest of its people. It's disappointing, for sure, but if one understands what it takes to build a nation, and a nation that has, you know, where people have been shut out for so long, it's inexcusable, the actions of some people, but you can't expect that it will be a perfect transition.
What happened to Trans-Africa after the fall of apartheid?
Trans-Africa is still active. Even during the South African work, it was also active on other Africa issues, and it continues to be active around Africa and diaspora issues, working with Congress, working with communities. There has been a focus on the diaspora work on working with Haiti, which has been intensified as a result of the earthquake. But they were working with them before.
Well, back to what's going on in South Africa. South Africa is facing the same issues the whole world faces. And for us to sit there and say, well, you should solve your problems of poverty, is a bit hypocritical. I mean, this is the main problem in South Africa, poverty and inequality. And to me, that's a global issue. And as far as I can see, that's the issue of the next century for us all to solve on a world level.
And many people have said that the the miracle of South Africa is that the transition was done so peaceably that all of the predictions of bloodbaths didn't pan out, that right. Nelson Mandela turned out to be one of the most exemplary leaders any country's ever had after gaining a new approach to government. Connie, what are you going to do next? Are you going to be making a film about America again?
Well, I won't be making another film in a while because I still have a lot to do on this. We're cutting it down to be a package for international TV, so I have to cut every episode down to 52 minutes. We are also making our DVDs, and we're going to have lots of extras because we have so many stories on the cutting room floor to make this all available and so that people can easily use it. We're building a big website for this. So we still have a lot to do before we're finished.
And we didn't even cover a lot of things. We didn't mention Barbara Castle, the British MP, who played such an important role in this story. But I'm very pleased that we were able to speak to one of the heroes who's been a guest on our show, Adjoa Dunmutton, who worked for Trans Africa and actually played such an important role in changing American policy. And thank you, Connie Field. The 8.5-hour documentary series is at the Film Forum. It opened yesterday, and you can see it on any of well, there are three different packages, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can go three different days if you want to.
Or you can be really maniacal and watch it all at once.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having me.